Burning it seemed to her the proper thing to do, and the idea that her concept of the proper thing to do might be short-circuited by something so piddling as a bank Xerox machine and a couple of rolls of quarters. That blip just never crossed her screen, my friend. His other deductions might be like houses built on quicksand, but this view of Annie Wilkes seemed to him as solid as the Rock of Gibraltar. Because of his researches for Misery, he had rather more than a layman's understanding of neurosis and psychosis. And he knew that although a borderline psychotic might have alternating periods of deep depression and almost aggressive cheerfulness and hilarity, the puffed and infected ego underlay all, positive that all eyes were upon him or her, positive that he or she was starring in a great drama. The outcome was a thing for which untold millions waited with held breath. Such an ego simply forbade certain lines of thought. These lines were predictable because they all stretched in the same direction, from the unstable person to objects, situations, or other persons outside of the subject's field of control, or fantasy. To the neurotic there might be some difference, but to the psychotic they were one and the same. Annie Wilkes had wanted fast cars destroyed, and so to her there had been only one copy. Maybe I could have saved the damn thing by telling her there were more. She would have seen destroying the manuscript was futile. His breathing, which had been slowing towards sleep, suddenly caught in his throat and his eyes widened. Yes, she would have seen it was futile. She would have been forced to acknowledge one of those lines leading to a place beyond her control. The ego would be hurt, squealing. I have such a temper! If she had been clearly faced with the fact that she couldn't destroy his dirty book, might she not have decided to destroy the creator of the dirty book instead? After all, there was no copy of Paul Sheldon. His heart was beating fast. In the other room, the clock began to bong, and overhead he heard her thumping footfalls across the ceiling. The faint sound of her urinating, the toilet flushing, the heavy pad of her feet as she went back to bed, the creak of the spring. "You won't make me mad again, will you?" His mind suddenly tried to break into a gallop, an overbred trotter trying to break stride. What, if anything, did all this dime-store psychoanalysis mean in terms of his car? About when it was found? What did it mean to him? "Wait a minute," he whispered in the dark. "Wait a minute, wait a minute. Just hold the phone. Slow down." He put his arm across his eyes again and again conjured up the state trooper with the dark sunglasses and the overlong sideburns. "We found an overturned car halfway down Humbuggy Mountain," the state trooper was saying, "and blah-de-blah-de-blah." Only this time Annie doesn't invite him to stay for coffee. This time she isn't going to feel safe until he's out of her house and far down the road. Even in the kitchen, even with two closed doors between them and the guest room, even with a guest doped to his ears, the trooper might hear a groan. If his car was found, Annie Wilkes would know she was in trouble, wouldn't she? "Yes," Paul whispered. His legs were beginning to hurt again, but in the dawning horror of this recognition, he barely noticed. She would be in trouble not because she had taken him to her house, especially if it was closer than Sidewinder, and so Paul believed it to be. For that, they would probably give her a medal and a lifetime membership in the Misery Chastain fan club. To Paul's endless chagrin, there actually was such a thing. The problem was she had taken him to her house and installed him in the guest room and told no one. No phone call to the local ambulance service. "This is Annie up on the Humbuggy Mountain Road, and I've got a fellow here who looks a bit like King Kong used him for a trampoline." The problem was she had filled him full of dope to which he was certainly not supposed to have access, not if he was even half as hooked as he thought he was. The problem was, she had followed the dope with a weird sort of treatment, sticking IV needles in his arms, splinting his legs with sawed-off pieces of aluminum crutches. The problem was, Annie Wilkes had been on the stand up there in Denver, and not as a supporting witness either, Paul thought. "I'd bet the house and a lot on that." So she watches the cop go down the road in his spandy-clean cruiser. Spandy-clean except for the caked chunks of snow and salt nestled in the wheel wells and under the bumpers, that is. And she feels safe again. but not too safe, because now she is like an animal with its wind up, way, way up. The cops will look and look and look, because he is not just good old Joe Blow from Kokomo. He is Paul Sheldon, the literary Zeus from whose brow sprang Misery Chastain, darling of the dump bins and sweetheart of the supermarkets. Maybe when they don't find him, they'll stop looking, or at least look someplace else. But maybe one of the roidmen saw her going by that night, and saw something funny in the back of old Bessie. Something wrapped in a quilt. Something vaguely manlike. Even if they hadn't seen such a thing, she wouldn't put it past the roidmans to make up a story to get her in trouble. They didn't like her. The cops might come back, and next time her houseguest might not be so quiet. He remembered her eyes darting around aimlessly when the fire in the barbecue pot was on the verge of getting out of control. He could see her tongue slicking her lips. He could see her walking back and forth, hands clenching and unclenching, peeking every now and then into the guest room where he lay lost in his cloud. Every now and then she would utter, "Goodness!" to the empty rooms. She had stolen a rare bird with beautiful feathers, a rare bird which came from Africa. And what would they do if they found out? Why, put her up on the stand again, of course. Put her up on the stand again in Denver. And this time she might not walk free. He took his arm away from his eyes. He looked at the interlocking W swaying drunkenly across the ceiling. He didn't need his elbow over his eyes to see the rest. She might hang on to him for a day or a week. It might take a follow-up phone call or visit to make her decide to get rid of her rara avis. But in the end she would do it, just as wild dogs begin to bury their illicit kills after they've been hunted a while. She would give him 5 pills instead of 2, or perhaps smother him with a pillow. Perhaps she would simply shoot him. Surely there was a rifle around somewhere. Almost everyone living in the high country had one, and that would take care of the problem. No. Not the gun. Too messy. Might leave evidence. None of that had happened yet because no one had found the car. They might be looking for him in New York or L.A., but no one was looking for him in Sidewinder, Colorado. But in the spring. The W's straggled across the ceiling. Washed. Wiped. Wasted. The throbbing in his legs was more insistent. The next time the clock bonged, she would come, but he was almost afraid she would read his thoughts on his face, like the bare premise of a story too gruesome to write. His eyes drifted left. There was a calendar on the wall. It showed a boy riding a sled down a hill. It was February, according to the calendar, but if his calculations were right, it was already early March. Annie Wilkes had just forgotten to turn the page. How long before the melting snows revealed his Camaro with its New York plates and its registration in the glove compartment, proclaiming the owner to be Paul Sheldon? How long before that trooper called on her, or until she read it in the paper? How long until the spring melt? 6 weeks? 5? That could be the length of my life, Paul thought, and began shuddering. By then his legs were fully awake. And it was not until she had come in and given him another dose of medicine that he was able to fall asleep. The next evening she brought him the Royal. It was an office model from an era when such things as electric typewriters, color TVs, and touch-tone telephones were only science fiction. It was as black and as proper as a pair of high-button shoes. Glass panels were set into the sides, revealing the machine's levers, springs, ratchets, and rods. A steel return lever, dull with disuse, jutted to one side like a hitchhiker's thumb. The roller was dusty, its hard rubber scarred and pitted. The letters Royal ran across the front of the machine in a semicircle. Grunting, she set it down on the foot of the bed between his legs, after holding it up for his inspection for a moment. He stared at it. Was it grinning? Christ, it looked like it was. Anyway, it already looked like trouble. The ribbon was a faded two-tone red over black. He had forgotten there were such ribbons. The sight of this one called up no pleasant nostalgia. Well, she was smiling eagerly. What do you think? It's nice, he said at once. A real antique. Her smile clouded. I didn't buy it for an antique. I bought it for second hand. Good second hand. He responded with immediate glibness. Hey, there ain't no such thing as an antique typewriter. Not when you come right down to it. A good typewriter lasts damn near forever. These old office babies are tanks. If he could have reached it, he would have patted it. If he could have reached it, he would have kissed it. Her smile returned. His heartbeat slowed a little. I got it at Used News. Isn't that a silly name for a store? But Nancy Dartmonger, the lady who runs it, is a silly woman. Annie darkened a little, but he saw at once that she was not darkening at him. The survival instinct he was discovering might be only instinct itself, but it created some really amazing shortcuts to empathy. He found himself becoming more attuned to her moods, her cycles. He listened to her tick as if she were a wounded clock. As well as silly, she's bad, Dartmonger. Her name ought to be Whoremonger. Divorced twice and now she's living with a bartender. That's why when you said it was an antique... It looks fine, he said. She paused a long moment, and then said, as if confessing, It has a missing N. Does it? Yes. See? She tilted the typewriter up so he could peer at the banked semicircle of keys and see the missing striker like a missing molar in a mouthful of teeth, worn but otherwise complete. I see. She set it back down. The bed rocked a little. Paul guessed the typewriter must weigh as much as 50 pounds. It had come from a time when there were no alloys, no plastics. Also, no six-figure book advances. No movie tie-in editions. No USA Today. No Entertainment Tonight. No celebrities doing ads for credit cards or vodka. The royal grinned at him, promising trouble. She wanted $45 but gave me 5 off because of the missing N. She offered him a crafty smile. No fool she, it said. He smiled back. The tide was in. That made both smiling and lying easy. Gave it to you? You mean you didn't dick her? Annie preened a little. I told her N was an important letter, she allowed. Well, good for you. Damn! Here was a new discovery. Sycophancy was easy once you got the hang of it. Her smile grew sly, inviting him to share a delicious secret. I told her N was one of the letters in my favorite writer's name. It's 2 of the letters in my favorite nurse's name. Her smile became a glow. Incredibly, a blush rose in her solid cheeks. That's what it would look like, he thought, if you built a furnace inside the mouth of one of those idols in the H.R. Rider Haggard stories. That is what it would look like at night. You fooler, she simpered. I'm not, he said, not at all. Well. She looked off for a moment, not blank, but just pleased, a little flustered, taking a moment to gather her thoughts. Paul could have taken some pleasure in the way this was going, if not for the weight of the typewriter, as solid as the woman and also damaged. It sat there, grinning with its missing tooth, promising trouble. The wheelchair was much more expensive, she said. Ostomy supplies have gone right out of sight since I... She broke off, frowned, cleared her throat. Then she looked back at him, smiling. But it's time you began sitting up, and I don't begrudge the cost one tiny bit. And of course you can't type lying down, can you? No. I've got a board. I cut it to size. And paper. Wait. She dashed from the room like a girl, leaving Paul and the typewriter to regard each other. His grin disappeared the moment her back was turned. The royals never varied. He supposed later that he had pretty well known what all this was about, just as he supposed he had known what the typewriter would sound like, how it would clack through its grin like that old comic strip character Ducky Daddles. She came back with a package of Carassable Bond and shrink wrap, and a board about 3 feet wide by 4 feet long.
Look!
She put the board on the arms of the wheelchair that stood by his bed, like some solemn skeletal visitor. Already he could see the ghost of himself behind that board, pent in like a prisoner. She put the typewriter on the board facing the ghost, and put the package of Corrascible Bond, the paper he hated most in all the world because of the way the type blurred when the pages were shuffled together, beside it. She had now created a kind of cripple's study.
What do you think?
It looks good, he said, uttering the biggest lie of his life with perfect ease, and then asked the question to which he already knew the answer. What will I write there, do you think?
Oh, but Paul,
she said, turning to him, her eyes dancing animatedly in her flushed face.
I don't think. I know. You're going to use this typewriter to write a new novel. Your best novel. Misery's Return.
Misery's Return. He felt nothing at all. He supposed a man who had just cut his hand off in a power saw might feel the same species of nothing, as he stood regarding his spouting wrist with dull surprise.
Yes!
Her face shone like a searchlight. Her powerful hands were clasped between her breasts.
It'll be a book just for me, Paul. My payment for nursing you back to health. The one and only copy of the newest misery book. I'll have something no one else in the world has, no matter how much they might want it. Think of it!
Annie, misery is dead. But already, incredibly, he was thinking, I could bring her back. The thought filled him with tired revulsion, but no real surprise. After all, a man who could drink from a floor bucket should be capable of a little directed writing.
No, she's not, Annie replied dreamily. Even when I was so mad at you, I knew she wasn't really dead. I knew you couldn't really kill her. Because you're good.
Am I? He said, and looked at the typewriter. It grinned at him. We're going to find out just how good you are, old buddy, it whispered.
Yes!
Annie, I don't know if I can sit in that wheelchair. Last time
it hurt, you bet it did. And it will hurt the next time, too. Maybe even a little more. But there will come a day, and it won't be long either, although it may seem longer to you than it really is, when it hurts a little less, and a little less, and a little less.
Annie, will you tell me one thing?
Of course, dear.
If I write this story for you...
Novel, a nice big one like all the others, maybe even bigger.
He closed his eyes for a moment, then opened them. Okay, if I write this novel for you, will you let me go when it's done? For a moment, unease slipped cloudily across her face. And then she was looking at him carefully, studiously.
You speak as though I were keeping you prisoner, Paul.
He said nothing, only looked at her.
I think that by the time you finish, you should be up to the strain of meeting people again,
she said.
Is that what you want to hear?
That's what I wanted to hear, yes.
Well, honestly, I knew writers were supposed to have big egos, but I guess I didn't understand that meant ingratitude, too.
He went on looking at her, and after a moment she looked away, impatient and a little flustered. At last he said,
I'll need all the misery books if you've got them, because I don't have my concordance. Of course I have them, she said. Then... What's a concordance?
It's a loose-leaf binder where I have all my misery stuff, he said. Characters and places, mostly, but cross-indexed 3 or 4 different ways. Timelines, historical stuff. He saw she was barely listening. This was the second time she'd shown not the slightest interest in a trick of the trade that would have held a class of would-be writers spellbound. The reason, he thought, was simplicity itself. Annie Wilkes was the perfect audience. A woman who loves stories without having the slightest interest in the mechanics of making them. She was the embodiment of that Victorian archetype, constant reader. She did not want to hear about his concordance and indices, because to her, misery and the characters surrounding her were perfectly real. Indices meant nothing to her. If he had spoken of a village census in Little Dunthorpe, she might have showed some interest.
"I'll make sure you get the books. They're a little dog-eared, but that's a sign a book has been well-read and well-loved, isn't it?"
"Yes," he said. "No need to lie this time." "Yes, it is."
"I'm going to study up on bookbinding," she said dreamily. "I'm going to bind Misery's Return myself. Except for my mother's Bible, it'll be the only real book I own."
"That's good," he said, just to say something. He was feeling a little sick to his stomach.
"I'll go out now so you can put on your thinking cap," she said. "This is exciting, don't you think so?"
"Yes, Annie, I sure do."
"I'll be in with some breasted chicken and mashed potatoes and peas for you in half an hour. Even a little jello, because you've been such a good boy. And I'll make sure you get your pain medication right on time. You can even have an extra pill in the night if you need it. I want to make sure you get your sleep, because you have to go back to work tomorrow. You'll mend faster when you're working, I bet."
She went to the door, paused there for a moment, and then grotesquely blew him a kiss. The door closed behind her. He did not want to look at the typewriter and for a while resisted, but at last his eyes rolled helplessly toward it. It sat on the bureau, grinning. Looking at it was a little like looking at an instrument of torture, boot, rack, strappado, which is standing inactive, but only for the moment.
"I think that by the time you finish, you should be up to the strain of meeting people again."
"Oh, Annie, you were lying to both of us. I knew it, and you did, too. I saw it in your eyes." The limited vista now opening before him was extremely unpleasant. 6 weeks of life, which he would spend suffering with his broken bones and renewing his acquaintance with Misery Chastain, nay, Carmichael, followed by a hasty interment in the backyard. Or perhaps she would feed his remains to Misery the pig. That would have a certain justice, black and gruesome though it might be. Then don't do it. Make her mad. She's like a walking bottle of nitroglycerin as it is. Bounce her around a little. Make her explode. Better than lying here suffering. He tried looking up at the interlocked W's, but all too soon he was looking at the typewriter again. It stood atop the bureau, mute and thick and full of words he did not want to write, grinning with its one missing tooth. "I don't think you believe that, old buddy. I think you want to stay alive even if it does hurt. If it means bringing Misery back for an encore, you'll do it. You try, anyway. But first you're going to have to deal with me. And I don't think I like your face." "Makes us even," Paul croaked. This time he tried looking out the window, where fresh snow was falling. Soon enough, however, he was looking at the typewriter again, with avid, repulsed fascination, not even aware of just when his gaze had shifted. Getting into the chair didn't hurt as much as he had feared, and that was good, because previous experience had shown him that he could hurt plenty afterwards. She set the tray of food down on the bureau, then rolled the wheelchair over to the bed. She helped him to sit up. There was a dull, thudding flare of pain in his pelvic area, but it subsided. And then she leaned over, the side of her neck pressing against his shoulder like the neck of a horse. For an instant he could feel the thump of her pulse, and his face twisted in revulsion. Then her right arm was firmly around his back, her left under his buttocks. "Try not to move from the knees while I do this," she said, and then simply slid him into the chair. She did it with the ease of a woman sliding a book into an empty slot in her bookcase. Yes, she was strong. Even in good shape, the outcome of a fight between him and Annie would have been in doubt. And as he was now, it would be like Wally Cox taking on Boom Boom Mancini. She put the board in front of him.
"See how well it fits," she said, and went to the bureau to get the food.
"Annie."
"Yes?"
"I wonder if you could turn that typewriter around so it faces the wall." She frowned.
"Why in the world do you want me to do that?"
because I don't want it grinning at me all night. Old superstition of mine, he said. I always turn my typewriter to the wall before I start writing. He paused and added, every night while I am writing, as a matter of fact.
It's like step on a crack, break your mother's back, she said. I never step on a crack if I can help it.
She turned it around so it grinned at nothing but blank wall.
Better?
Much.
You are such a silly,
she said, and came over and began to feed him. He dreamed of Annie Wilkes in the court of some fabulous Arabian caliph, conjuring imps and genies from bottles, and then flying around the court on a magic carpet. When the carpet banked past him, her hair streamed out behind her. Her eyes were as bright and flinty as the eyes of a sea captain navigating among icebergs. He saw it was woven all in green and white. It made a Colorado license plate.
Once upon a time, Annie was calling. Once upon a time it came to pass. This happened in the days when my grandfather's grandfather was a boy. This is the story of how a poor boy. I heard this from a man who. Once upon a time. Once upon a time.
When he woke up, Annie was shaking him, and bright morning sun was slanting in the window. The snow had ended.
Wake up, sleepyhead! Annie was almost trilling. I've got yogurt and a nice boiled egg for you, and then it will be time for you to begin.
He looked at her eager face and felt a strange new emotion. Hope. He had dreamed that Annie Wilkes was Scheherazade, her solid body clad in diaphanous robes, her big feet stuffed into pink sequined slippers with curly toes, as she rode on her magic carpet and chanted the incantatory phrases which open the doors of the best stories. But of course it wasn't Annie that was Scheherazade. He was. And if what he wrote was good enough, if she could not bear to kill him until she discovered how it all came out, no matter how much or how loudly her animal instincts yelled for her to do it, that she must do it, might he not have a chance? He looked past her and saw she had turned the typewriter around before waking him. It grinned resplendently at him with its missing tooth, telling him it was all right to hope and noble to strive, but in the end it was doom alone which would count. She rolled him over to the window, so the sun fell on him for the first time in weeks, and it seemed to him he could feel his pasty white skin, dotted here and there with minor bedsores, murmur its pleasure and thanks. The window panes were edged on the inside with a tracery of frost, and when he held out his hand, he could feel a bubble of cold like a dome around the window. The feel of it was both refreshing and somehow nostalgic, like a note from an old friend. For the first time in weeks, it felt like years, he was able to look at a geography different from that of his room with its unchanging verities, blue wallpaper, picture of the Arc de Triomphe, the long, long month of February symbolized by the boy sliding downhill on his sled. He thought that his mind would turn to that boy's face and stocking cap each time January became February, even if he lived to see that change of months another 50 times. He looked into this new world as eagerly as he had watched his first movie, Bambi, as a child. The horizon was near. It always was in the Rockies, where longer views of the world were inevitably cut off by up-tilted plates of bedrock. The sky was a perfect early morning blue, innocent of clouds. A carpet of green forest climbed the flank of the nearest mountain. There were perhaps 70 acres of open ground between the house and the edge of the forest. The snow cover over it was a perfect and blazing white. It was impossible to tell if the land beneath was tilled earth or open meadow. The view of this open square was interrupted only by one building, a neat red barn. When she spoke of her livestock, or when he saw her trudging grimly past his window, breaking her breath with the impervious prow of her face, he had imagined a ramshackle outbuilding like an illustration from a child's book of ghost stories, roof tree bowed and sagging from years of snow weight, windows blank and dusty, some broken and blocked with pieces of cardboard, long double doors perhaps off their tracks and swaying outward. This neat and tidy structure with its dark red paint and neat cream-colored trim looked like the five-car garage of a well-to-do country squire masquerading as a barn. In front of it stood a Jeep Cherokee, maybe 5 years old, but obviously well cared for. To one side stood a Fisher plow in a homemade wooden cradle. To attach the plow to the Jeep, she would only need to drive the Jeep carefully up to the cradle so that the hooks on the frame matched the catches on the plow and throw the locking lever on the dashboard. The perfect vehicle for a woman who lived alone and had no neighbor she could call upon for help, except for those dirty Bertie Roydmans, of course. And Annie probably wouldn't take a plate of pork chops from them if she was dying of starvation. The driveway was neatly plowed, a testament to the fact that she did indeed use the blade, but he could not see the road. The house cut off the view. "I see you're admiring my barn, Paul." He looked around, startled. The quick and uncalculated movement awoke his pain from its doze. It snarled dully in what remained of his shins, and in the bunched salt dome that had replaced his left knee. It turned over, needling him from where it lay imprisoned in its cave of bones, and then fell lightly asleep again. She had food on a tray. Soft food, invalid food, but his stomach growled at the sight of it. As she crossed to him, he saw that she was wearing white shoes with crepe soles. "Yes," he said. "It's very handsome." She put the board on the arms of the wheelchair, and then put the tray on the board. She pulled a chair over beside him and sat down, watching him as he began to eat.
"Fiddledy-foof. Handsome is as handsome does, my mother always said. I keep it nice because if I didn't, the neighbors would yap. They're always looking for a way to get at me, or start a rumor about me. So I keep everything nice. Keeping up appearances is very, very important. As far as the barn goes, it really isn't much work as long as you don't let things pile up. Keeping the snow from breaking in the roof is the oogiest part."
The oogiest part, he thought. Save that one for the Annie Wilkes lexicon and your memoirs. If you ever get a chance to write your memoirs, that is. Along with Dirty Birdie and Fiddledy Foof and all the others, which I'm sure will come up in time.
2 years ago, I had Billy Haversham put heat tapes on the roof. You throw a switch and they get hot and melt the ice. I won't need them much longer this winter, though. See how it's melting on its own.
He had a forkful of egg halfway to his mouth. It stopped in midair as he looked out at the barn. There was a row of icicles along the eave. The tips of these icicles were dripping, dripping fast. Each drop sparkled as it fell onto a narrow canal of ice which lay at the base of the barn side.
"It's up to 45 degrees, and it's not even 9 o'clock.
Annie was going on daily, as Paul imagined the rear bumper of his Camaro, surfacing through the rotted snow for the sun to twinkle on.
"Of course it won't last. We've got a hard snapper 3 ahead of us yet, and probably another big storm as well. But spring is coming, Paul. And my mother always used to say that the hope of spring is like the hope of heaven."
He put his fork back down on the plate with the egg still on it.
"Don't want that last bite? All done?"
"All done," he agreed. And in his mind he saw the Roydmans driving up from Sidewinder, saw a bright arrow of light strike Mrs. Roydman's face, making her wince and put a shielding hand up.
"What's down there, Ham? Don't tell me I'm crazy. There's something down there. Reflection damn near burned my eye out. Back up. I want to take another look." "Then I'll just take the tray," she said, "and you can get started."
She favored him with a glance that was very warm.
"I just can't tell you how excited I am, Paul."
She went out, leaving him to sit in a wheelchair and look at the water running from the icicles which clung to the edge of the barn. "I'd like some different paper if you could get it," he said when she came back to put the typewriter and paper on the board.
"Different from this?"
she asked, tapping the cellophane-wrapped package of Carassable Bond.
"But this is the most expensive of all. I asked when I went to the paper patch."
"Didn't your mother ever tell you that the most expensive is not always the best?" Annie's brow darkened. Her initial defensiveness had been replaced by indignation. Paul guessed her fury would follow.
No, she did not. What she told me, Mr. Smart Guy, is that when you buy cheap, you get cheap.
The climate inside her, he had come to discover, was like springtime in the Midwest. She was a woman full of tornadoes waiting to happen, and if he had been a farmer observing a sky which looked the way Annie's face looked right now, he would have at once gone to collect his family and herd them into the storm cellar. Her brow was too white. Her nostrils flared regularly like the nostrils of an animal scenting fire. Her hands had begun to spring limberly open and then snatch closed again, catching air and squashing it. His need for her and his vulnerability to her screamed at him to back off, to placate her while there was still time, if indeed there still was, as a tribe in one of those Rider Haggard stories would have placated their goddess when she was angry by making sacrifice to her effigy. But there was another part of him, more calculating and less cowed, which reminded him that he could not play the part of Scheherazade if he grew frightened and placatory whenever she stormed. If he did, she would storm all the more. If he didn't have something she badly wants, this part of him reasoned, she would have taken you to the hospital right away or killed you later on to protect herself from the Roidmans. Because for Annie, the world is full of Roidmans. For Annie, they're lurking behind every bush. And if you don't bell this bitch right now, Paulie, my boy, you may never be able to. She was beginning to breathe more rapidly, almost to hyperventilate. The rhythm of her clenching hands was likewise speeding up, and he knew that in a moment she would be beyond him. Gathering up the little courage he had left, trying desperately to summon exactly the right note of sharp and yet almost casual irritability, he said, "And you might as well stop that. Getting mad won't change a thing." She froze as if he had slapped her, and looked at him, wounded. "Annie," he said patiently, "this is no big deal."
"It's a trick," she said. "You don't want to write my book, and so you're making up tricks not to start. I knew you would. Oh, boy. But it's not going to work.
That's silly," he said. "Did I say I wasn't going to start?"
"No. No, but..."
"That's right. Because I am. And if you come here and take a look at something, I'll show you what the problem is. Bring that Webster pot with you, please."
"The what?"
"The little jar of pens and pencils," he said. "On newspapers, they sometimes call them Webster pots, after Daniel Webster." This was a lie he had made up on the spur of the moment, but it had the desired effect. She looked more confused than ever, lost in a specialist's world of which she had not the slightest knowledge. The confusion had diffused, and thus defused, her rage even more. He saw she now didn't even know if she had any right to be angry. She brought over the jar of pens and pencils and slammed them down on the board, and he thought, "God damn, I won." No, that wasn't right. Misery had won. But that isn't right either. It was Scheherazade. Scheherazade won.
"What?"
she said grumpily.
"Watch."
He opened the package of Carasible and took out a sheet. He took a freshly sharpened pencil and drew a line on the paper. Then he took a ballpoint pen and drew another line parallel to the first. Then he slid his thumb across the slightly waffled surface of the paper. Both lines blurred smudgily in the direction his thumb was traveling, the pencil line slightly more than the one he had drawn with the pen. "See?"
"So what?"
"Ribbon ink will blur, too," he said. "It doesn't blur as much as the pencil line, but it's worse than the ballpoint ink line."
"Were you going to sit and rub every page with your thumb?"
"Just the shift of the pages against each other will accomplish plenty of blurring over a period of weeks or even days," he said. "And when a manuscript is in work, it gets shifted around a lot. You're always hunting back through to find a name or a date. My God, Annie, one of the first things you find out in this business is that editors hate reading manuscripts typed on Carasible Bond almost as much as they hate handwritten manuscripts."
"Don't call it that. I hate it when you call it that."
He looked at her, honestly puzzled. "Call what what?"
"When you pervert the talent God gave you by calling it a business. I hate that."
I'm sorry.
You ought to be, she said stonily. You might as well call yourself a whore.
No, Annie, he thought, suddenly filled with fury. I'm no whore. Fast Cars was not about being a whore. That's what killing that goddamn bitch Misery was about, now that I think about it. I was driving to the West Coast to celebrate my liberation from a state of whoredom. What you did was to pull me out of the wreck when I crashed my car and stick me back in the crib again. $2 straight up, $4 I take you around the world. And every now and then I see a flicker in your eyes that tells me a part of you way back inside knows it, too. A jury might let you off by reason of insanity. But not me, Annie. Not this kid. Good point, he said. Now, going back to the subject of the paper.
I'll get you your cock-a-doodle paper, she said sullenly. Just tell me what to get and I'll get it.
As long as you understand I'm on your side.
Don't make me laugh. No one has been on my side since my mother died 20 years ago.
Believe what you want, then, he said. If you're so insecure you can't believe I'm grateful to you for saving my life, that's your problem. He was watching her shrewdly, and again saw a flicker of uncertainty, of wanting to believe in her eyes. Good. Very good. He looked at her with all the sincerity he could muster, and again in his mind he imagined shoving a chunk of glass into her throat, once and forever letting out the blood that serviced her crazy brain. At least you should be able to believe that I am on the book side. You spoke of binding it. I assume that you meant binding the manuscript, the typed pages.
Of course that's what I meant.
Yes, you bet. Because if you took the manuscript to a printer, it might raise questions. You may be naive about the world of books and publishing, but not that naive. Paul Sheldon is missing. And your printer might remember receiving a book-length manuscript concerning itself with Paul Sheldon's most famous character right around the time the man himself disappeared, mightn't he? And he'd certainly remember the instructions. Instructions so queer any printer would remember them. One printed copy of a novel-length manuscript. Just one. What did she look like, officer? Well, she was a big woman. Looks sort of like a stone idol in an H.R. Rider Haggard story. Just a minute, I've got her name and address here in the files. Just let me look up the carbons of the invoices.
Nothing wrong with the idea either, he said. A bound manuscript can be damned handsome. Looks like a good folio edition. But a book should last a long time, Annie. And if I write this one on Carrasible, you're going to have nothing but a bunch of blank pages in 10 years or so. Unless, of course, you just put it on the shelf. But she wouldn't want that, would she? Christ, no. She'd want to take it down every day, maybe every few hours. Take it down and gloat over it. An odd, stony look had come into her face. He did not like this mulishness, this almost ostentatious look of obduration. It made him nervous. He could calculate her rage, but there was something in this new expression that was as opaque as it was childish.
You don't have to talk any more, she said. I already told you I'd get you your paper.
What kind?
In this business supply store you go to.
The paper patch.
Yes, the paper patch. You tell them you'd like 2 reams. A ream is a package of 500 sheets.
I know that. I'm not stupid, Paul.
I know you're not, he said, becoming more nervous still. The pain had begun to mutter up and down his legs again, and it was speaking even more loudly from the area of his pelvis. He had been sitting up for nearly an hour, and the dislocation down there was complaining about it. Keep cool, for God's sake. Don't lose everything you've gained. But have I gained anything? Or is it only wishful thinking?
Ask for 2 reams of white long-grain Mimeo. Hammerhill Bond is a good brand. So is Triad Modern. 2 reams of Mimeo will cost less than this one package of Carrasible, and it should be enough to do the whole job, write and rewrite.
I'll go right now, she said, getting up suddenly.
He looked at her, alarmed, understanding that she meant to leave him without his medication again, and sitting up this time as well. Sitting already hurt,
The pain would be monstrous by the time she got back, even if she hurried. "You don't have to do that," he said, speaking fast. "The carassable is good enough to start with. After all, I'll have to rewrite anyway."
"Only a silly person would try to start a good work with a bad tool."
She took the package of carassable bond, then snatched the sheet with the two smudged lines and crumpled it into a ball. She tossed both into the wastebasket and turned back to him. That stony, obdurate look covered her face like a mask. Her eyes glittered like tarnished dimes.
"I'm going to town now," she said. "I know you want to get started as soon as you can, since you're on my side."
She spoke these last words with intense, smoking sarcasm, and Paul believed more self-hate than she would ever know.
"And so I'm not even going to take time to put you back in your bed."
She smiled, a pulling of the lips that was grotesquely puppet-like, and slipped to his side in her silent white nurse's shoes. Her fingers touched his hair. He flinched. He tried not to, but couldn't help it. Her dead-alive smile widened.
"Although I suspect we may have to put off the actual start of Misery's return for a day, or two, perhaps even three. Yes, it may be as long as 3 days before you're able to sit up again, because of the pain. Too bad. I had champagne chilling in the fridge. I'll have to put it back in the shed."
"Annie, really, I can start if you just..."
"No, Paul."
She moved to the door and then turned, looking at him with that stony face. Only her eyes, those tarnished dimes, were fully alive under the shelf of her brow.
"There is one thought I'd like to leave you with. You may think you can fool me or trick me. I know I look slow and stupid. But I am not stupid, Paul. And I am not slow."
Suddenly her face broke apart. The stony obduracy shattered, and what shone through was the countenance of an insanely angry child. For a moment, Paul thought the extremity of his terror might kill him. Had he thought he had gained the upper hand? Had he? Could one possibly play Scheherazade when one's captor was insane? She rushed across the room at him, thick legs pumping, knees flexing, elbows chopping back and forth in the stale sickroom air like pistons. Her hair bounced and joggled around her face as it came loose from the bobby pins that held it up. Now her passage was not silent. It was like the tread of Goliath striding into the valley of bones. The picture of the Arc de Triomphe clacked affrightedly on the wall. She screamed, and brought her fist down on the bunched salt dome that had been Paul Sheldon's left knee. He threw back his head and howled, veins standing out in his neck and on his forehead. Pain burst out from his knee and shrouded him, whitely radiant in the center of a nova. She tore the typewriter off the board and slammed it down on the mantel, lifting its weight of dead metal as he might have lifted an empty cardboard box.
"So you just sit there," she said, lips pulled back in that grinning rictus. "And you think about who is in charge here, and all the things I can do to hurt you if you behave badly or try to trick me. You sit there and you scream if you want to, because no one can hear you. No one stops here because they all know Annie Wilkes is crazy. They all know what she did, even if they did find me innocent."
She walked back to the door and turned again, and he screamed again when she did, in anticipation of another bull-like charge, and that made her grin more widely. "I'll tell you something else," she said softly. "They think I got away with it, and they're right. Think about that, Paul, while I'm in town getting your cock-a-doodle paper." She left, slamming the bedroom door enough to shake the house. Then there was the click of the lock. He leaned back in the chair, shaking all over, trying not to shake because it hurt, not able to help it. Tears streamed down his cheeks. Again and again he saw her flying across the room. Again and again he saw her bringing her fist down on the remains of his knee, with all the force of an angry drunk hammering on an oak bar. Again and again he was swallowed in that terrible blue-white nova of pain.
"Please, God, please,"
he moaned, as the Cherokee started outside with a bang and a roar. Please, God, please. Let me out of this or kill me. Let me out of this or kill me.
The roar of the engine faded off down the road, and God did neither. And he was left with his tears and the pain, which was now fully awake and raving through his body. He thought later that the world in its unfailing perversity would probably construe those things which he did next as acts of heroism, and he would probably let them. But in fact, what he did was nothing more than a final staggering grab for self-preservation. Dimly, he seemed to hear some madly enthusiastic sportscaster, Howard Cosell or Warner Wolf, or perhaps that all-time crazy Johnny Most, describing the scene as if his effort to get at her drug supply before the pain killed him was some strange sporting event. A trial substitution for Monday night football, perhaps. What would you call a sport like that, anyway? Run for the dope?
I just cannot believe the guts this Sheldon kid is displaying today.
The sportscaster in Paul Sheldon's head was enthusing.
I don't believe anyone in Annie Wilkes Stadium, or in the home viewing audience for that matter, thought he had the slightest chance of getting that wheelchair moving after the blow he took, but I believe... Yes, it is. It's moving. Let's look at the replay.
Sweat ran down his forehead and stung his eyes. He licked a mixture of salt and tears off his lips. The shuddering would not stop. The pain was like the end of the world. He thought, there comes a point when the very discussion of pain becomes redundant. No one knows there is pain the size of this in the world. No one. It is like being possessed by demons. It was only the thought of the pills, the Novril that she kept somewhere in the house, which got him moving. The locked bedroom door, the possibility the dope might not be in the downstairs bathroom as he had surmised, but hidden somewhere, the chance she might come back and catch him. These things mattered not at all. These things were only shadows behind the pain. He would deal with each problem as it came up, or he would die. That was all. Moving caused the band of fire below his waist and in his legs to sink in deeper, cinching his legs like belts studded with hot, inward-pointing spikes. But the chair did move. Very slowly the chair began to move. He had managed about 4 feet before realizing he was going to do nothing more useful than roll the wheelchair past the door and into the far corner unless he could turn it. He grasped the right wheel, shuddering. Think of the pills. Think of the relief of the pills. And bore down on it as hard as he could. Rubber squeaked minutely on the wooden floor, the cries of mice. He bore down, once strong and now flabby muscles quivering like jelly, lips peeling back from his gritted teeth, and the wheelchair slowly pivoted. He grasped both wheels and got the chair moving again. This time he rolled 5 feet before stopping to straighten himself out. Once he'd done it, he grayed out. He swam back to reality 5 minutes later, hearing the dim, goading voice of that sportcaster in his head.
He's trying to get going again. I just can't believe the guts of this Sheldon kid.
The front of his mind only knew about the pain. It was the back that directed his eyes. He saw it near the door and rolled over to it. He reached down, but the tips of his fingers stopped a clear 3 inches short of the floor, where one of the 2 or 3 bobby pins that had fallen from her hair as she charged him lay. He bit his lip, unaware of the sweat running down his face and neck and darkening his pajama shirt.
I don't think he can get that pin, folks. It's been a fantastic effort, but I'm afraid this is where it all ends.
Well, maybe not. He let himself slouch to the right in the wheelchair, at first trying to ignore the pain in his right side, pain that felt like an increasing bubble of pressure, something similar to a tooth impaction, and then giving way and screaming. As she said, there was no one to hear him anyway. The tips of his fingers still hung an inch from the floor, brushing back and forth just above the bobby pin, and his right hip really felt as if it might simply explode outward in a squirt of some vile white bone jelly. Oh, God, please, please help me. He slumped farther in spite of the pain. His fingers brushed the pin but succeeded only in pushing it a quarter of an inch away. Paul slid down in the chair, still slumped to the right, and screamed again at the pain in his lower legs. His eyes were bulging, his mouth was open, his tongue hung straight down between his teeth like the pull on a window shade. Little drops of spittle ran from its tip and spatted on the floor. He pinched the bobby pin between his fingers, tweezed it, almost lost it, and then it was locked in his fist. Straightening up brought a fresh slough of pain, and when the act was accomplished, he could do no more than sit and pant for a while, his head tilted as far as the uncompromising back of the wheelchair would allow, the bobby pin lying on the board across the chair's arms. For a while, he was quite sure he was going to puke, but that passed. "What are you doing?" part of his mind scolded wearily after a while. "Are you waiting for the pain to go away? It won't. She's always quoting her mother, but your own mother had a few sayings too, didn't she?"
Yes, she had. Sitting there, head thrown back, face shiny with sweat, hair plastered to his forehead, Paul spoke one of them aloud now, almost as an incantation. "There may be fairies, there may be elves, but God helps those who help themselves."
"Yeah. So stop waiting, Polly. The only elf that's going to show up here is that all-time heavyweight, Annie Wilkes."
He got moving again, rolling the wheelchair slowly across to the door. She had locked it, but he believed he might be able to unlock it. Tony Bonassaro, who was now only so many blackened flakes of ash, had been a car thief. As part of his preparation for riding fast cars, Paul had studied the mechanics of car thievery with a tough old ex-cop named Tom Twyford. Tom had shown him how to hotwire an ignition, how to use the thin and limber strip of metal car thieves called Slim Jims to yank the lock on a car door, how to short out a car burglar alarm. Or, Tom had said on a spring day in New York some 2.5 years ago, let's say you don't want to steal a car at all. You got a car, but you're a little low on gas. You got a hose, but the car you pick for the free donation has got a locking gas cap. Is this a problem? Not if you know what you're doing, because most gas cap locks are strictly Mickey Mouse. All you really need is a bobby pin. It took Paul 5 endless minutes of backing and filling to get the wheelchair exactly where he wanted it, with the left wheel almost touching the door. The keyhole was the old-fashioned sort, reminding Paul of John Tenniel's Alice in Wonderland drawings, set in the middle of a tarnished keyplate. He slid down a bit in the wheelchair, giving out a single barking groan, and looked through it. He could see a short hallway leading down to what was clearly the parlor, a dark red rug on the floor, an old-fashioned divan, upholstered in similar material, a lamp with tassels hanging from its shade. To its left, halfway down the hallway, was a door which stood ajar. Paul's pulse beat quickened. That was almost surely the downstairs bathroom. He had heard her running enough water in there, including the time she had filled the floor bucket from which he had enthusiastically drunk. And wasn't it also the place she always came from before giving him his medicine? He thought it was. He grasped the bobby pin. It spilled out of his fingers onto the board and then skittered toward the edge. "No!" he cried hoarsely, and clapped a hand over it just before it could fall. He clasped it in one fist and then grayed out again. Although he had no way of telling for sure, he thought he was out longer this second time. The pain, except for the excruciating agony of his left knee, seemed to have abated a tiny bit. The bobby pin was on the board across the arms of the wheelchair. This time he flexed the fingers of his right hand several times before picking it up.
"Now," he thought, unbending it and holding it in his right hand, "you will not shake. Hold that thought. You will not shake."
He reached across his body with a pin and slipped it into the keyhole, listening as the sportscaster in his mind, so vivid, described the action. Sweat ran steadily down his face like oil. He listened, but even more, he felt. "The tumbler in a cheap lock is nothing but a rocker," Tom Twyford had said, seesawing his hand to demonstrate. "You want to turn a rocking chair over? Easiest thing in the world, right?
Just grab the rockers and flip the mother right over. Nothing to it. And that's all you gotta do with a lock like this. Slide the tumbler up, then open the gas cap quick before it can snap back.